On today's episode of Biomedical Design Stories, we're joined by Ken Turner and Kendall Berlin O'Connell, and we'll be discussing healthcare and the life sciences ecosystem here in Massachusetts. And I'm joined by my co-host, Brian Johnson, president of MassMedic.
Thanks, Matt. Here's a bit about our guests. Ken Turner is the president and CEO of the Massachusetts Life Sciences Center. Ken is a seasoned executive who brings a blend of public, private, and military experience to the MLSC. Kendall Berlin O'Connell is the president and COO of MassBio, where she leads the strategic direction, global expansion, and business operations of the organization.
All right, Ken and Kendall, thank you guys so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. I'd like to start with a discussion about your leadership roles at Mass Life Sciences Center and MassBio. Ken, you assumed your leadership role coming from outside of industry at an incredibly dynamic period of time in the middle of a pandemic. Can you talk just a little bit about your leadership experience and kind of how you've approached that?
Yeah, thanks, Matt, and I couldn't have summed it up better. It's not every day that you get to transition into a new role as new leader in a new industry in an international pandemic, once in a lifetime, you know, every century, right, this happens. And I remember when the board selected me in October of last year and I transitioned over in December, that I stopped and counted the number of leadership opportunities I had across my career in the military and in the private sector and now the public sector, and I came up with about 50 to 56. And I thought to myself, you know, kind of what my normal formula would be and how do you execute that when you're doing it all remotely? And to be honest with you, I had a lot of concern about how do you do it? And then I, kind of panicked for a moment. And then the submariner in me kind of swelled up and I went, okay, wait a minute, even keel, you know, you can do this, you can figure it out. And I just went back to the same formula, but recognized I just had to do it a little differently, which was, you know, focus on the people, focus on building relationships with the right stakeholders like MassBio and Kendall, for example, and then focus on strategy. And so I literally laid out a 100-day transition plan for my board and for my co-chairs, Secretary Keneally and Secretary Heffernan, and just executed it the same way, but just did it all by Zoom. I'm an old country boy, and I prefer to meet people face-to-face like we're doing today. I want to see people's eyes. I want to see those micro movements and tell whether or not you're really paying attention to me or whether I really got you or don't got you. And you can't do that in Zoom. But we made it through it. And as soon as I could get out and start shaking hands and kissing babies in person, I did. And in fact, I've been in this role for just about 10 months now. And I think the last time I got an update from the marketing team, we were somewhere in the 80s to 90s in terms of the number of events that I've attended. And in fact, I have one in Worcester this afternoon.
Kendall, what about you? I mean, assuming your leadership role in this dynamic period of time in the middle of the pandemic, I mean, you've been with MassBio for 13 years, but, what have you leaned on in terms of your leadership?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. But first, I want to start. It's been really fun to watch you in this role over the last year, right? So, I mean, I think we started our dialogue, you know, within weeks of you starting.
Yep, we
but
did.
To see the passion, the leadership, the progress that's already happened in your first year in this position has truly been incredible and really fun to watch, maybe not as fun to live.
I have to say, I watch your, I can just follow your LinkedIn profile to see the who's who and the state and, where I need to be, focusing. And because, you really have covered so much territory.
Yeah, it feels like you've cloned yourself.
I wish. I wish.
So I have been at MassBio for 13 years, and I've had the opportunity to really work my way up through the ranks. Like Ken, not from industry. I was an attorney practicing elder law and estate planning before, so totally new to industry, but I did have the benefit of having 13 years of industry-related experience under my belt as I transitioned into this leadership role. I think it was interesting, right, because as a membership organization, we have over 1,400 members who are looking to us to provide advocacy, to provide guidance, to provide real-time direction during a period which there was so much unknown. And then, of course, we have our staff too. So it was balancing, how are we understanding and sympathetic to staff who we're all going through this very emotional time period, but we're still trying to run a business. So how do we sort of reconcile those two and keep the ship on course, so to speak, to my military Navy friend over here? And it was interesting, and it was such a challenge. It was certainly, for me, the most challenging thing that I'd ever experienced. Also, MassBio is an organization going through a huge transition, right? So I know Bob Coughlin was a guest on your last episode, but he'd been at MassBio for 14 years. And so he was the steady captain of this ship. And so ensuring that our board, our staff, our membership felt like we were well positioned to continue the successful trajectory that we have been on to guide us through this pandemic. But at the same time, think about what's to come, because we can't just be focused on surviving. This industry is moving. It's so fast paced, and we know, right? Because we've seen the influence that the industry had through COVID, right? 95 of our member companies here, Massachusetts headquartered companies, pivoted to focus on COVID-related research. All of the vaccines have a direct correlation to Massachusetts. And so what that caused was incredible excitement and interest in the industry, leading to record-breaking investment. So we had to also be thinking about what's down the pipeline and what do we need to be doing as an industry leader to continue to stay on top. So all of these things were kind of happening at the same time, but it certainly felt like we were treading water.
You know, I love talking to you guys because I think we all have similarly kind of strange jobs in some respects, right? When I first took this job, it took me, I've been on this job for 3 years. I still say, what do I do? Because like, it feels like I'm doing something different every day. But, you know, I felt for me, like, and I would be interested for you guys, you know, COVID, I think, brought out the best of what MassMedic can do. I believe from watching what you did at MassBio, it brought out the best of what MassBio can be. And I think the thing that, you know, was surely, you know, lacking until Ken got here in that sort of window where we, I felt like, gosh, you know, this is really a 3-4-head job here that we need. So I would imagine if the pandemic hadn't happened, your mission would be much different than it is now. Do you feel in some ways that it helped focus you or?
No, to be honest with you, Brian, I don't think so. I came to it with, you know, kind of the same notion that if you go back to the inception of the center, right, when it was launched in 2008, I mean, the mission of the center is really straightforward in my mind, because I like to keep things as simple as I can make them, right? And I'm a marketing guy by training. And I learned a long time ago that the best commercials, the best brands had an element of simplicity to them, right? That the consumer could recall them very easily. And so the way I think about the center is we are an economic and investment entity with a mission towards driving preeminence of the life sciences in the Commonwealth. That's it. That's my elevator speech. That's 5 seconds, right? It took me 5 seconds to say that, right? That's what we are. And if you go back to our inception, to where we are today, you know, 13 or 14 years later, that's not changed. Mm-hmm. I think Kendall hit on this, though. And you mentioned it, I think, Matt, a little earlier when we were talking about your conversation with Governor Patrick, which is we may be on top, and by God, by any metric you can think of, we are, and I could start going through the litany of metrics.
We are. I'll just confirm that.
But we are. We are. We got a lot to celebrate, right?
Absolutely.
We got a lot to be proud of. And Kendall knows that I'm very proud of our ecosystem. But I worry. Mm-hmm. I worry a lot. I mean, I don't sleep well at all. And it's because I think there, you know, the way I describe it to my staff is we have what I call uneven success. And what I mean by that is, you know, there are real gaps in our workforce. Mm-hmm. There are real gaps in our manufacturing capacity and ability within the state. And so there are points where I look at it and go, yeah, boy, when it comes to R&D, we smash them. You know, nobody can touch us. I mean, we've got brain power, right? Governor Patrick talked about that. You know, the secret sauce of Massachusetts is our brain power. You know, Texas is oil. You know, ours corn. The Commonwealth is brain power. And we've harnessed that effectively. We really have. And it's been a tremendous success. But when I look around at our ecosystem at the workforce level, right, I don't see very many people who look like her or very many people who look like me. They look like you. And we got to change that. And I think we can change that if we can figure out a way to drive more manufacturing to the Commonwealth. And if we can do that, then now you can bring people into those jobs that don't have to have advanced degrees. They just simply need training, either upscaling or rescaling, right? And so that's how I think about our strategy. And so to answer your question, I don't think it's changed, but I have said to the staff that each and every day, the one thing I think about every day is jobs, jobs, jobs. We are going to be in the jobs business. That's what I tell them. We're going to be in the jobs business. Now, that's different, right? Mm-hmm. Because before, we were kind of in the company business. We're in the startup business. We're in the you know, business development business. And I'm still doing all those things, right? But at the same time, I think about how can we drive jobs?
Yeah.
And how can we drive jobs for common people? That's the difference.
Kendall, you've been in the job for 13 years. Do you remember a moment where you thought, man, Kendall Square Biotech, it's moved from a hot industry to this is like, you know, I always call it sort of Hollywood for health tech or like, you know, I mean, was there a moment in your memory where it clicked for you?
I would say probably in the last 5 years is where it really became the place, you know, in every conversation. And often, right, as the State Trade Association for Life Sciences, we speak with our counterparts in other states, and they're always asking, well, how can we be Kendall Square? And we can say, well, you know, you got to have your flagship, you know, academia, and, you know, you got to make sure there's investment in startups. But we've got a secret sauce that no one can recreate. And it really is, and this was Bob Coughlin's favorite thing to say, right? This partnership between industry, government, and academia. But that is truly it. Also, right, the proximity to all of these things. There's no other place that can create that. But I think what's so exciting, and you hit on this, and sort of off of the question that you asked, you know, had things changed because of the pandemic? And right before the pandemic, MassBio issued our 2025 strategic report. So every 5 years, we conduct a strategic report to help build the roadmap for MassBio's goals and objectives over that next 5 years, but not just for MassBio, for the industry in Massachusetts. And fundamentally, all of those focus areas, right, and we launched the report early 2020, right before the pandemic hit, actually. So they are all incredibly relevant. It's just timing. And priority has changed, and some of it has become far more urgent. As you know, we've had this conversation so many times, Ken and I, the importance of workforce, the importance of tapping into historically underrepresented communities and bringing those communities into the life sciences and the life science to those communities. I mean, it's of utmost importance. And to the point of what you said, if we don't figure out a way to fill these workforce needs, in 5 years, we might sit around this table and have a conversation. Remember when we were the best place in the world for life sciences? I mean, that's how dire the situation could be.
Right.
The great news is with Ken's leadership, with Brian's leadership, with our leadership at MassBio, we are completely invested in working collaboratively in finding short-term and long-term solutions with partnership from government, of course.
Right. I think one of the interesting things, we're going to talk a little more about manufacturing, which obviously is a passion of mine, but you know, I think it's an opportunity and a risk for us in the Commonwealth is we have, I mean, nationally, we have a system of kind of pipeline innovation in the United States, right? So early stage research and then pushing it through the phases of commercialization. Other countries, you know, competitors, China, Germany, Japan, they're much more focused on manufacturing-led innovation. And I think that's such an opportunity for us to connect those two things, because if we don't, I think the downside is that lots of people are focused on life sciences right now because of the pandemic, and they could lead in manufacturing-led innovation, process innovation, all of these different areas to bring new technologies into the market. And so I think that we have this really big opportunity in the Commonwealth to connect those two things. And I want to talk a little bit just about your strategic visions. You know, you mentioned your five-year plan. You know, what are those plans for us? Workforce, I know, is one of them, manufacturing. But What are you guys focused on to ensure that we are continuing to lead the industry over the next 5 years, 10 years?
Well, you know, I just spent a few months working with a couple of consulting teams to try to think about the chart that, you know, the course that we should chart ahead, right, under my leadership. And again, I like to keep it simple. So we came up with a plan that said we're going to focus on innovation, and I'll talk about that a little bit. We're going to focus on biomanufacturing, and we're going to focus on what I call regionalization. And we're going to underpin those three pillars with workforce development and DE&I across those three pillars. And so how that'll work is on innovation, it comes down to, and I'll use the Moderna example. 10 years ago, you know, VCs didn't know what mRNA was and didn't invest in it. The Life Science Center did. And so the question for us, I think, is what's our next big innovation, a la AKA mRNA, that might be overlooked, if not by support from entities like the center? And so we've got to stay focused on innovation. When I talk about biomanufacturing, I mentioned it earlier, I think about it this way. China, India, you know, offshoring small molecule manufacturing, I get, right? It is completely price-driven and margin-driven, and it's very hard for us to compete here in the United States because of our workforce and our standard of living. We're the richest country in the world. But when I think about large molecule manufacturing, the more complicated manufacturing, I think that's where we may have an opportunity. And I say may, because I don't know if this is right. And so we got to be willing to, like, step out there and try it, and I could be wrong. But I think we need to convince our companies. And, for example, you know, last time I looked, I think of the top 25, you know, international biopharma companies in the world, I think 18 or 19 of them are right here in the Commonwealth. But they don't necessarily do their manufacturing here in the Commonwealth. They go to Pennsylvania. They go to Maryland, or they go to North Carolina or Texas, and places like that where the land is cheaper and the workforce is cheap and et cetera, et cetera. And so I think we've got to work with our industry partners to convince them to do their manufacturing here. And that's where the regionalization comes in. We've got to push outside of the greater Boston-Cambridge metro area, right? If I drew a radius, I'm a nuclear weapons officer, so I like looking at maps with big rings around them with a very different idea. But nuclear weapons aside, when I think about, you know, the radius around Boston, Cambridge, I'm going, why can't we do manufacturing in Lawrence? I was just out there a couple of weeks ago looking at the Riverwalk, right, and getting a tour of Lawrence. Or Lowell. Or why can't we go north, right, to Danvers? Or west? And, you know, in the Central Mass, in the Springfield, in the Pittsfield, right? I was out there, about a month ago, right, for the Innovation Conference. And so land will be cheaper, workforce will be accessible, can be trained, and, oh, by the way, the people that you're going to train are going to be people now from neighborhoods that wouldn't necessarily participate in the industry. So that's where the DE&I piece comes in. So it all ties together. Now, all of that I just said sounded simple, but I recognize it's complex, and I recognize it's hard, and it's going to take work on our part, right, collectively, working with our industry partners, convincing them that they've got to do business here. And I think that's where government and that's where advocacy groups and come in, and with us working together with our industry partners, we can do this. But we've got to work together. It's all about collaboration. That's how we built the ecosystem to begin with. It isn't just about dollars.
God, that five-year number kind of scares me. What you said earlier, right? I mean,
yeah.
If you think about how quick innovation cycles work, how quick this stuff changes, right? I mean,
think of the development pipeline, right? 20 million square feet of development is in the pipeline in the next 3 to 4 years.
Right.
And that's where we got that 40,000 net new job number, because that's happening, right? And think of this, there's only been 40 million square feet of lab and manufacturing space that's been built in the last 10 years.
Right.
I know.
That's.
And by the way, we can't meet the demand today, right?
Right.
Every company I visit, without exception, every single company says, I can't find the talent that I'm looking for.
Right.
Every single company.
Right.
But when you said, you know, why can't manufacturing happen in Lawrence and Lowell? It absolutely can, and it has to. And we've got geography on our side, right? The value proposition for these companies that are doing their R&D in Boston or Cambridge or other places, but as they're scaling and looking to manufacture, particularly in those complex areas like cell and gene therapy, proximity to R&D is critically important.
Right.
So you can be in Lawrence and you're an hour and 20 minutes from your R&D. I mean, there's value in that. And that, and if you think, if you are looking to scale and you go to North Carolina, well, that's fine. There's a lot of value there, but you don't have that proximity.
Right. It is not uncommon for us to engage with a startup in, you know, Cambridge, who's really surprised to find our companies a 2-hour drive away. And so that connective tissue to manufacturers that are here, I think, is one thing we can work on. Okay, we're going to leave it right there and take a quick break. We'll be right back to talk more with Ken and Kendall about the life sciences workforce.
Boyd Technologies is an advanced materials and technology company operating in the medical device and life sciences market. We're experts in regulated single-use devices and liquid media solutions. Our growth platform provides a full suite of services for design and development, advanced manufacturing, and fulfillment operations. To learn more, visit us at boydtech.com.
I want to go back to the 40,000 jobs number. Are those where are those in the job market? And so are they manufacturing jobs? Are they more a sort of PhD level, lab jobs?
Yeah.
What are they?
Yeah, they span the spectrum, certainly, right? I mean, these companies are fully integrated. They need, employees at every level. So a relatively small portion of that is manufacturing, but that's still thousands of jobs that we need, right? So I would say, maybe 10 to 15% is, manufacturing. Right. But absolutely PhD level, and then everything in between. And that's where regionalization is so important, because for those entry level jobs, sometimes all the requirements are a certificate or an associate's degree. But there's wonderful jobs in the life sciences for folks that might have, gone to school for, have a law degree.
Right.
Or have
marketing,
right. Communications. Yes, exactly. And so it's really about changing the narrative and making sure that people don't think that you have to have a PhD in a very complicated science to work in this industry, because we need everybody if we're going to be able to fill those 40,000 jobs.
So we say, okay, every company is saying we need workers. Where are the workers? Where are the workers? I mean, like, to me, that I agree with you. That's what keeps me. Yeah. That's what, like, I spend more time thinking about, where are the workers? Are we going to have to build them, or are we going to have to retrain them?
Both.
I think it's both. I actually do. I actually think it's both. I think this is where I think COVID really does come in, because we are in this funky phenomena where we've got millions of people out of work, right? And literally, we've got millions of jobs unfilled. Mm-hmm. As we speak, right? We have a higher than, normal unemployment rate. I don't remember the number off the top of my head. I think the last time I looked, it may have been 4% or so. I'm a little bit leery to quote a number, but I think that was the last number I saw. And so you say, well, why aren't these people connecting to these jobs, right? Well, it's because in many cases, those jobs were crappy jobs, right? They're jobs without benefits. They're jobs with, hellacious hours. There are jobs where people aren't being treated with dignity and respect. And so, without calling out hospitality or whatever, but those are jobs that people are now taking a look at and going, you know what? I did that, done that, got a T-shirt, a belt buckle, and a cap, and I'm not doing that anymore. I'm going to, now reevaluate my prospects and think about where I go next. And I think that's where the opportunity lies.
Yes.
Is because we're in this funky pause, to your point, Brian, where folks are like just sitting in idle and treading water, as we were talking earlier, now is the opportunity to say, life sciences, you come with us and we're going to retrain you,
yes,
right? put you in an apprentice program, and 8 months later, 9 months later, you're going to come out the other end with a certificate and with a starting job as a technician in a biomanufacturing plant, and now you're making $50,000 to $60,000, plus you got benefits, plus you can go back to school because your employer is going to pay for it. And oh, by the way, if you get sick, you get paid when you stay home. Oh, by the way, if you get pregnant, you get leave. You get treated like a human being.
Yeah.
And I think that's our sell.
It's such an attractive
industry. I think that's our sell. Mm-hmm.
And it's all tied to doing work around for solutions for patients,
correct,
right? So not only are you making
correct
very generous salaries, you have wonderful benefits, but there's a story and you're part of that story. And it's an important
that's
story.
Correct.
Yeah, I love talking about this, but we you know, we're in the supply chain to the industry, and a lot of the products we make are components or we contract manufacture products, but it's always this incredible experience when our clients come in and explain to our staff what they do, what the connection to the patient is, what the drug does, what the component does in their device for the patient. And I think that, again, is this connective tissue to, you know, if we can expand regional access, if we can create more inclusivity from underserved parts of the states or populations, I think I still think there's a ways to go in terms of workforce, but I do think that there is, we can motivate the workforce and we can grow the workforce to support the industry, not just in that biomanufacturing production moment, but in all the moments that support it.
Right.
You know, upstream and downstream.
Yeah, I think it's our job as in our roles though, to push companies to articulate better. You don't have a job opening, you know, because if I'm a displaced service worker and I'm like, frankly, I don't get paid enough to tell someone to put their mask on or to take their mask off or to end up in some viral video getting screamed at or something, you know, or to just be treated like crap. I think our companies, and I believe like we have to keep pushing them, I'd love to get your opinion on this. Do our companies do a good enough job telling people, this is where you'll be in a year when you come work with us. This is how we're going to help change your life in 1 year, in 5 years, in 10 years. Or do they say to those prospective employees, we all have jobs open, please come in here. Our job description is totally written in Greek.
Well, I think it's even a step before that. And maybe this is what you're thinking. Before we're even telling prospective employees what the benefits are, it's about changing what the requirements are.
Right.
You don't need a bachelor's degree to work in these manufacturing jobs, yet often those job posts require a bachelor's degree and 5 to 7 years of experience. So that's creating an immediate barrier for prospective employees. So you coming from a restaurant, maybe you're a manager of your restaurant, you're seeing this, oh, I could never get that job. That isn't true. So there's layers of changing the narrative, but that's the industry perspective. We've got to think about what are the actual requirements that are needed for these respective jobs, and then telling the story. When we bring you in, this is the benefit. There's a growth trajectory for you as an employee within this organization. There's a mission that you're part of, right? That's tied to a patient. There's the inspiration that you get, and you feel this, and you know this, when there's nothing better than when we get to go to a member company and be in their lab and meet with their scientists, and you can feel the passion that they have. This is their life's work, and they know that they're changing lives because of it. So it's, and I do think our companies tell that story, and if you're there, you can feel it, but it's about changing some of those barriers to entry, really.
Yeah. I couldn't more violently agree with Kendall on that point. As a marketer, I think we need to do a better job, mm-hmm, quite frankly. Kendall hit on it. You know, one of the beautiful things of this role is when I get out and visit a company, I am normally blown away. You know, I go on a tour and I'm at, you know, Mustang Bio, mm-hmm, for example. And I'm sitting in a conference room and they're walking me through what they're working on. And literally my mind just goes, oh my God, like, wow. I mean,
it's
this,
like watching a sci-fi movie.
Like,
you're like,
literally,
how is this possible?
Literally, right? As a twice cancer survivor, the stuff I mean, it's mind-boggling science that's happening. I've been in companies where they are literally trying to cure deafness,
unbelievable science going on. And so I think we need to do a better job of selling what we're working on, you know, and so people will get inspired and want to work in this industry. Because it is, I mean, there's some incredible changes in innovation that's coming down the pike that, you know, will make mRNA look like.
Right, curative changes, right?
Correct.
Not solutions, curative.
Correct, correct.
I think a lot of the narrative around healthcare is so negative. Or has been, that it's hard to overcome that sometimes when you're on this leading edge of, you know, front edge of innovation where you're seeing, and that's true in med tech too. I mean, we're seeing really incredible changes in smart materials, robotics, miniaturization. You know, you could sort of go on, and the same thing's happening in biotech with all these new modalities. It's an incredible time to be in this industry. So when it comes to DE&I, when it comes to inclusivity, I mean, how do we bring that down to, how do we do that?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it is marketing. It comes down to, you know, we've got to figure out where the people are, what the right positioning and messaging is, and then hit them hard. And so, you know, one of the things that I'm working on right now in partnership with Kendall and Brian and other partners in the industry is we're convening a workforce task force to really think about in the life sciences, how do we address our workforce needs? And that is a collaboration between industry, government, our academic institutions, and our non-for-profits. The beauty of the center is that we have the power to convene and to bring people together in collaboration. And so that's what we're going to do in my leadership. That's what we're going to do while I'm here, is we're going to bring people together to tackle the big problems. And to me, that's the big problem. And I will sit here and tell you, quite frankly, Matt, I don't have the answers today, but I don't need to have the answers. Now, that sounds a bit smug, but here's why. When I talked about that 50 to 60 teams that I've led over the course of my career, here's what I found out. A, I don't want to be the smartest guy in the room. I want to surround myself with people that are way smarter than me. And then give them a problem, and as we say in the military, work the problem. And give them the resources to work the problem and get the hell out of their way. And guess what will happen? They'll solve it. I've seen it time and time again. So I know that by bringing smart people together, giving them a clear problem to solve and working that problem, we're going to come up with creative solutions that's going to solve this problem. I'm totally confident of it. And so, yeah, I don't have the answers today, but she does, he does, and the other folks that I'm working with do. And as soon as we kick this thing off officially, which I'm hoping to do in early January, we're going to get down to rolling up our sleeves and solving the problem.
How analogous is this to the challenge you faced at Massport when you took that?
It's exactly what it is. To me, this is the Massport model. I came to what Brian is referring to is I worked for 7 years at the Port Authority as the head of DE&I. And oh, by the way, I had that much DE&I experience as in zero when I took the job, just like I had life science experience of zero when I took this job. But again, I surround myself with smart people. And so it's about leadership, right? Is that I don't have to have the answers. We didn't know what innovation we were going to bring to commercial real estate. I just knew over the horizon where I wanted to go. And I surrounded myself with very smart people and allowed them to come up with the solutions. And granted, yes, the board had to be on board. Yes, our CEO had to be on board. I mean, yes, it took some risk involved in this. And you got to be willing to take risks. As I recall in your podcast with Governor Patrick, he talked about risk and failure. Well, think about, you know, where I come from as a military officer. I mean, our lives are full of risk. Not recklessness, mind you, but most certainly risk. And you have to be bold. You have to be willing to take bold steps, recognizing that you may not get to where you want to go. But by God, you'd be a heck of a lot further than where you were, even if you fail. And if you fail, then take a step back, look at it honestly, do a postmortem, understand what worked, look at what didn't work, dust yourself off, and by God, go at it again. And keep going at it again, and keep going at it again until you get it. You know, I, the example I use is, you know, look at inventors like Edison. Did he invent the light bulb by sitting at his bench one day and clicking a button? I'll bet you it was thousands and thousands of experiments that led to that innovation. And that's how you have to think about it. And so we can get there, but we only going to get there through collaboration with very smart people and, quite frankly, letting them work the problem.
If I might just add on to that a little bit. So you're go at it again and again and again. I mean, that's really key to this. And so when we think about regionalization and DE&I as it relates to workforce, it's sort of a chicken and the egg thing, because if we can't work with our companies to institute good DE&I practices as they are now, they're not going to be able to recruit more diverse networks. Right. And that's something that MassBio is very focused on. We've been leaders around DE&I for many years now. This isn't just, you know, oh, the last year we've responded. For years, we've built that platform. And we created a CEO pledge letter in August of 2020, and that had six core principles for companies to focus on. And really, their CEOs to say, DE&I is a business priority for our organization, right? This isn't a check the box thing. It's a business priority. And when it's a business priority, that means there's numbers tied to it, right? And so that means that every growth milestone during that company's trajectory, DE&I is front and center. And so that's kind of key, right? If you are looking, you know, I'm from a minority community, and I'm looking at a company and all I see is white men there, well, I don't really want to work at that company. But if I see a diverse workforce, if I see a diversity mission statement for that company, well, I know there's a commitment, and I can suspect that they probably have a very inclusive company culture. Right? And I think that there's probably a growth trajectory for me in that organization. So certainly it's a priority with our existing companies, and that's how we're going to be able to recruit these minority individuals and communities into the life sciences.
Absolutely.
What about women? I mean, can you speak to that as a executive leader yourself and sort of the challenge? I mean, we have, there's a lot of different statistics, whether it's venture funding for female-backed startups or whether it's just executives at the board level or senior leadership level. I mean, we need to do better there.
Absolutely. And actually, Ken and I had this conversation the other night offline. Yeah, we need to do better. It has been a challenge, right? You know, MassBio conducted a strategic report focused on gender equity in 2017. And at that time, the data showed that men and women are entering the industry at the same rates. But we're seeing significant drop-off at the mid-career level and even more significantly at the C-suite level. And as a, you know, woman leader with two small children, the struggle is real. It has been difficult. Most of my board members don't even know I have kids, honestly, because I don't talk about my kids. I'm usually the only woman in the room. And I told Ken, I mean, there's still times where I'm the only woman in the room and some of those men don't even make eye contact with me. And that happens weekly. Yeah. And I've been in MassBio for 13 years. Right. They've got to know that I'm doing a lot of the work. but you know, my children, there's been major sacrifices, right? I've missed all the things, but I'm very fortunate in the regard that I have a wonderful support system. And I think the key to this is MassBio, as we look to be leaders around DE&I, we've also adopted very flexible schedules with individuals. I mean, family is the priority. There's never a time that someone comes to me and says, gee, I gotta go to a concert for my kids. And I'm like, leave now, get to that concert, because often I'm missing those concerts and I know how hard it is. And I think there have to be pathways. I've been very fortunate in the regard that I've had, right, there's mentors and then there's sponsors. And I've had sponsors, board level sponsors, that have seen opportunity for me that I don't even know that I saw for myself. And they've helped create those pathways for me, but it's intentional. It has to be intentional. And so for our companies, if you're making a commitment to DE&I, you have to intentionally make pathways for women, for Black and Brown employees, you know, for everybody. It has to be intentional.
And it has to start at the top.
Yes.
You know, the thing I should, you know, say when I was at Massport is DE&I is not something that you can have a grassroots bubble up revolution. That's not how it works. it has to be literally at the top. It has to be the board. It has to be the CEO. It has to be the president. They've got to own it. And they, and I mean really own it, mm-hmm. and be sincere about it. And the other word you use was my favorite word, which is intentionality. If you don't make this a priority and you talk about it every day and you hold your people accountable and you put metrics around it so that you can actually yes. measure it, because that's the other piece. It's one thing to talk about it. It's another to say, you know what? I'm going to hold your compensation at risk.
Yes.
Because I know that when I was in the private sector, if you gave me 10 objectives and 7 of them were tied to objective measures and 3 of them were what I call the fluff, guess what? I'm focused on the 7 because that's my bonus.
Well,
and oh, by the way, and I'm going to meet that 7
because
I'm going to get paid.
And that's where making this top, you know, top led and business priority is key. And also, I just want to add too, and it's not just within your employee base. You really, for these startup companies, you need to think about having a diverse board of directors as well.
Right. I also think you need to not be afraid of the numbers. You know, be, okay, so if you take a census and your numbers suck,
yep.
own it.
Oh, yep.
And you can't fix something if you're not looking at the actual like numbers. If you might not even
Amen.
Know that you only have 5% of
you sound like
employees.
A D&I director.
Yes.
well it's
that was my speech.
Yeah. Well,
was
it's so
if you
true.
Don't measure it, then how? You know, I used to always say, if you don't measure it, then how do I know where I'm starting from?
Yes.
Or where I want to go? Mm-hmm. And to your point, you can't be afraid of the numbers. If they suck, they suck.
Right. But you got to start somewhere. And so, actually, just this month, we released our D&I strategic report. And so what we did with those that CEO pledge letter and those 220 companies that signed on, their CEO signed on, we conducted a survey of progress. And this will be one of many. And progress has been overall incremental, but there has been progress. And we will continue to track, but also we will continue to provide tools, resources, and pathways for continued improvement. And I think that's the key, right? We have to continue to look forward and press on in a positive way. There's, you know, looking back isn't going to help us. We've got to just continue to make the commitment moving forward.
Well, and you have to understand, too, when you're talking DE&I, that it's not something that you're going to ever accomplish. And here's what I mean by that. There is no end.
Right.
It's continual improvement. And that's hard to get your mind around, right? I mean, even for me, right? I mean, that's just hard because I'm used to, like, you give me a mission, I go at it, I'm going to try to do everything I can to, you know, excel and overachieve, and then I can check the box because I'm done. Victory, right? Plant a flag, done. Let me move on to the next thing. That's not how D&I works.
Yes.
Yeah. I think for companies also, it's so important to... I talk about this a lot with my wife, who also works, you know, this is a competitive advantage for companies in the future. Mm-hmm. Younger, the generation coming into the workforce right now wants this. We just had one of our senior leaders come back from maternity leave, and she and her husband are struggling with the childcare issue equally. They're both working and they're both trying to figure it out. And we had to figure it out as a company, how we're going to be flexible and how we're going to work through this, because she's a superstar at our company. And that's just as important to her husband as it is to her. And it's important to all of our colleagues, you know, at our company, that we have that flexibility. And I don't think you're going to grow as a company if you're not pursuing these. I think you're going to hit a real roadblock with these workforce challenges very soon.
All the data supports that, Matt. Time and time again. I mean, there are so many studies out there that show the more diverse your workforce is, the more innovative your workforce is going to be.
Right. Better outcomes, better shareholder return.
Absolutely.
That's proven.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's proven. Literally proven by data.
That's why I think manufacturing is so key for us as an industry. And it's interesting because I always thought of our industry and our jobs as sort of pipelining new innovation, mm-hmm. you know, R&D. You know, I kind of fell into that trap of Massachusetts, the key to Massachusetts' success over the years has been reinvention. But
the reinvention part also sort of hides the really ugly part, which is we were the energy capital of the world and we lost that.
Right.
We were the clothing capital of the world and we lost that. We were the mainframe computing of the world, center of the world, and we lost that. You know where I, for me, and I'm, you know, the manufacturing piece. This is where we can actually change history, and we can stop sugarcoating our failures a little bit. And you know, and then I look at like the auto manufacturing industry in Detroit and how that built a black middle class in the Midwest. Which I don't think we've actually, at least in my history in Massachusetts, we've ever really accomplished that promise. We never built a black middle class based upon manufacturing.
The income disparity here in the city of Boston alone is repugnant. Mm-hmm. The average white family has an accumulated wealth of $235,000. And the average black family here in the city of Boston is eight. And when I say eight, I don't mean 8,000. I don't mean 80. I mean eight. And that's by the Boston Fed's study that was done. And the first time I saw that report as a DE&I director at Massport, I literally thought it was a typo. Mm-hmm. So we have a huge amount of work to do when it comes to income disparity here in the Commonwealth. And oh, by the way, these jobs will go a long way towards helping to close that gap.
Yes.
It's not going to be the silver bullet. It's not going to solve all of it. But by God, it can make a real difference in people's lives and in the community, right?
And generational and opportunity.
Generational wealth.
Yes.
Absolutely.
All right, let's leave it right there. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about advanced manufacturing in life sciences.
For more than a quarter of a century, MassMedic has been the voice of the groundbreaking medical technology industry in New England, advocating for sound public policy that supports innovation and fostering a community built on a shared purpose, saving and improving the lives of patients everywhere through medical technology. Since the beginnings of New England's dominance in health tech, our members, the women and men who make up MassMedic, are researching, designing, developing, supplying, manufacturing, and deploying the next generation of medical innovations around the globe. Heart of health tech beats here in Massachusetts. And at MassMedic, we're proud to be part of that journey. Learn more about how you can join our community at massmedic.com.
This kind of goes back to the storytelling marketing piece you were talking about earlier. We talked with Governor Patrick about this also, and he was saying, you know, I've always found it really hard to except that, you know, Roxbury is, you know, walking distance from Kendall Square, and, right. and black participation in the industry is, you know, so low, non-existent. But if we're talking about manufacturing, you know, manufacturing is not really happening anymore in Kendall Square. It's R&D. So how do we connect that manufacturing story, which is happening in these other parts of the state like Worcester, to communities like Roxbury to see that opportunity?
Back to the marketing uh-huh. piece. I think that's where the marketing comes in. And I also think that, you know, back to intentionality, right? To Kendall's point about being intentional. You know, I know, for example, there's a developer in town, a black developer,
yes.
who is building a building in Nubian Square.
Yes, it's right? so exciting.
Right, which mm-hmm. is very exciting. It's going to have a huge life science component in it. And that's right in the heart of Roxbury. And I think we got to do more of that.
Yeah.
I think government ought to be thinking about, if my headquarters is in Waltham, maybe my headquarters needs to be in Roxbury, Dorchester, or Mattapan. Just saying.
Yeah, I think there's layers to it, right? It's one, making sure we're marketing and telling the story yeah. of what the benefit is to prospective employees and what the benefit is to our companies, right?
Right?
To industry. But also it's creating those educational pathways and ensuring that they're readily accessible. So this Nubian Square model is so exciting because what's happening there is in partnership with so many different institutions and training programs. So there, it will have access to certificate level training.
Right.
It will have access to associate degree training and maybe more than that.
Right.
And that can be a model that can be replicated in so many other communities. opportunities. And that's what we are working on every single day. There's not a meeting that I'm sure I can speak for you on this that we have during the day where this isn't part of that conversation. And so it has to be intentional, and people are starting to listen, right? I mean, people are starting to get this, but it has to happen quickly. We need short-term solutions, and then we need long-term solutions.
I think it's so important. I mean, to me, it's become crystal clear to me that manufacturing is the key to this entire puzzle, and it's going to be something that I'm going to be working on. Hopefully, it'll be something I look back in my career and say, damn, that was a great use of my life.
Music to my ears. This man singing my song.
Because, well, if you were born in 1990 and you're 31 years old, you have not had a single year in your life where manufacturing in the United States meant anything to you. You were told your entire life, it's a dead-end job, that the factory will close, the company's going to leave you, GM's going to pick up and move to Mexico or move to China. You know, we got a big job to do to change this narrative. And
I agree.
This is where, Brian, we lean into our vocational high schools and our community college to ensure that they're helping sell the value of manufacturing in life sciences. It's a very different value proposition than, you know, car manufacturing or other types of manufacturing. This is exciting, and there's significant, as we've talked about, significant career trajectory in this industry.
Yeah,
and you're right. It's the next chapter of the life science industry here in Massachusetts. And
I think it's the most important one, because I just go back to, like, look at history. Look at what New Bedford was. I mean, look at what Nantucket was once.
Yep.
Nantucket was once Houston, Texas.
Yeah.
And like, if we're not, like, really intentional about taking this the next step, we're just going to repeat the same damn mistakes. But, like, I was enlightened a couple weeks back. I went to Springfield to talk to the mayor because of the Smith and Wesson thing. Mm-hmm. And I want, and like, how do we get those employees into med tech? And, you know, as soon as I was talking to him, I realized that this mayor, no one from my industry had ever gone to his office, sat down with him and told him, hey, you know, within an hour's drive, I can put kids with high school diplomas into $100,000 manufacturing jobs. I could just tell no one had ever come to him and put it in that terms. And I think that do you guys think that we've done a good enough job on the ground game and kind of talking to these mayors and talking?
Oh God, no.
Or even talking to the community colleges?
No.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, the perception, this dark, dirty, dangerous perception for manufacturing is, I mean, I it's sort of part of my own ethos just because I'm in manufacturing, but like you were talking about, Ken, go visit the facility. You know, our clean rooms look like operating rooms.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Our offices are bright and, you know, inspiring. You're not digging coal. And and our parking lots are full of Audis and BMWs and people are making good salaries. And I think, you know, that's a narrative that I just don't think, especially in rural communities where, you know, where we have manufacturing facilities, I don't think we're doing a good enough job to expose people to that, to get excited about it.
And I think and I think as a state, we've got to think about all the elements, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, when I was out in Western Mass, you know, a couple of things really stood out to me was, okay, which I hadn't thought about this, but housing.
Right.
Because I didn't think about that, but, you know, I think I was at a bar talking to somebody. It was a young person, and they were talking about all of the houses are basically summer homes for wealthy people. And so I went, I hadn't thought about that. So if you want to have a ready, willing, and able workforce in the western part of the state, we've got to think about housing. We've got to think about transportation. We've got to think about east-west.
Child care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rail connections. All of that comes into play. So that's why I say I don't think it's, you know, it's not a, you know, there's not going to be an easy lift here, but I do think we can do it.
Yeah.
But we only can do it if we're being intentional about it and thoughtful about
it. Yeah. And I will add, we certainly haven't done a good job on educating, you know, outside of Boston and Cambridge, the value of this industry. But over the last year, I'm seeing municipalities really ask ask questions. How do I bring life sciences to my community? And for the first time, really. So they're starting to understand, probably from a development perspective, because right now still the only thing that makes sense on paper is life science development. Yeah. But it's also educating the value that they can bring to their constituents. And it's life-changing. It's so exciting. Right.
And I do have mayors and city managers in droves reaching out to
yes.
me. You know, saying, hey, can I sit down and talk to
yeah,
you and your
you
team?
Can you come look at
or can you come out to my city? And mm-hmm. absolutely.
I've got this empty warehouse. This could be manufacturing.
Yeah, but what I tell them is industry will go where the workforce is. So first we have to prove there's a workforce there. So can, you know, my whole thing that I think we need to do a good job of is just, we're not a big state. Like you can drive from tip to tail in 2 hours. Like that's it.
Correct.
You know, I have family all over the country. They don't think twice about driving 2 hours.
Right.
So
I drive 2 hours to get to my office most days, each way.
It takes you an hour and a half to drive across Atlanta.
Yeah, I mean, people are,
or Houston.
There's just so many assumptions, though, that people make. Oh, they won't, people from Pittsfield won't drive past Springfield. I said, well, will they drive past Springfield for 125,000?
Right.
I mean, there's got to be some sort of number thing here, right? I mean, you know, believe me, I don't like commuting at all. But I mean, my paycheck's going to go up exponentially each mile. I'm going to drive.
Right. But it all plays, right? And we were talking about this before. I mean, Worcester's the best example.
Right.
Right? There was significant investment by the city of Worcester to recruit life sciences to their community. And by recruiting life sciences, there were all of these community benefits, right? Work-life balance. Now the ballpark is there. They've got incredible restaurant scene. They've built additional housing. They've got commuter rail access. But
they've
that didn't happen.
They've widened the roads, I noticed, even when I was out there the last time, driving through downtown, right?
And that didn't happen by accident, right? This was years of investment. Kevin O'Sullivan always believed that Worcester could be an incredible hub of life sciences, and there was that investment. But if some of these other communities make that strategic investment on all levels, they can have what Worcester now has.
I agree.
Can I ask a question about the vote? You still mentioned VOTEX and community colleges. Those are really important partners, but my sense is that a lot of their curriculums are guessing too about what industry needs. I don't get the sense that there has been the connective tissue there. And I know that you talked about this too. It's like it's no standard curriculum.
Right.
What can we do as an industry to help make sure they're teaching the stuff our companies want to hire?
Well, that's one of the things I want to take on head on with this working group that we're bringing together. You know, the consulting team that worked with me, which was an eye-opener for me, right, came back and they showed that California had uniform curricula for biomanufacturing in their community college system. Uniform. North Carolina has the same. Well, guess what? That's a selling point when you're talking to a company about a ready, willing, and able and trained workforce.
Yes.
We have, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 16 or 17 community colleges. And I'm saying, we don't have that? I don't know about you, but that's just nuts. Mm-hmm. Of course we should have that. And so that's one of the things that, you know, we've got to figure out working with our community college experts and with Secretary Pizer and the education group in government. We got to figure that out because that to me is just a no-brainer that we should have that.
And tie in industry to that. And we did it over a decade ago as it related to technician positions, and it worked really, really well. But let's use North Carolina as the example. They made this investment about a decade ago now, right? Standardizing the curriculum, and it's paid dividends. This is what made North Carolina competitive with Massachusetts.
Right.
Who would have thought? But they have ready-made workforce, and we're losing companies that are looking to scale, and they want to stay in Massachusetts, but we don't have, you know, turnkey locations, and we don't have ready-made workforce. And when you're scaling in complex areas like cell and gene therapy, it's a quick cycle, right? You're 12 to 18 months. You need a facility and workforce. And if it's not here in Massachusetts, well, you're forced to look somewhere else. And North Carolina is waving at us. So come on down, because we've got what you need.
I think there's a perception, too, that these are, that, you know, med tech and biotech are, because of the regulations, that they're these super well-defined things that you sort of can, you know, package and learn and just either through a, you know, a company or through, you know, different sort of external sources of education, they're very customized. You know, cell and gene therapy is new. You know, these are new you know, novel manufacturing processes that need to be set up, and there's a process that you have to teach to be able to commercialize these products. And I think if you could create some standardization with the help of industry and have an educational platform to teach it, you position yourself as a state that creates a lot of innovation and R&D to be really successful at commercializing all that. If you don't, it's sort of like each time you do it. I mean, we do this all the time as a company where new novel products are coming out of a lab and we have to design a new manufacturing process. We have to build new equipment. We have to run through a regulatory process that's slightly different every time. If you can train and teach for that nimbleness, you really have something in the connectivity between, you know, R&D and manufacturing, which is really worth getting excited about.
Yeah, and that's why we're so collectively excited about this workforce, because we know that we have to do this. Right. And Ken has been able to convene all the right stakeholders to get it done, and we understand the urgency of it.
Right. I mean, we literally just had an offsite just a few weeks ago in Gloucester where these two were there. We had about 50 people in the room across industry, the non-for-profit training, government, et cetera. I mean, we brought all these folks together, and that was just so we could plan how we were going to work together.
Yeah. And half the battle, right, is convening the key stakeholders. But now we know, I mean, we very much understand
we
the mission.
We spent the day kind of mapping this out, like how we're going to work together.
Yes.
Yeah, that was so great because it gave me clarity on how this could happen. I've heard all these things a lot, but I was so glad. Like,
I know how to herd kittens.
You sure do.
Military guy over here.
Sure do. And I know you'll understand the key is that industry needs to be a partner, not just the landing spot.
Absolutely.
We can't keep guessing about what they want and then getting pissed off because they don't hire my people. Like, that's not going to work.
Every company I visited since I took this job, we've talked about this issue. What I've said to them is, we're going to solve it, but we're only going to solve it with your help and your participation. And oh, by the way, you're going to have to help us fund whatever initiatives come out of this. It can't just simply be on the backs of government and the non-for-profits. You guys are going to benefit from this, so you're going to have skin in the game. And every single company have said to me, sign me up.
Yeah, industry.
Not a single one said, everyone said sign me up.
Yeah, they know, they hear, they understand, and they're ready to make the commitment. We just need to give them the roadmap to make that commitment.
Absolutely.
I just want to say thanks, you guys, for this time today, but also for what you're doing. I know, you know, for us as a small company, as a manufacturer, it is really meaningful support, both your organizations, Brian, your organization, and we couldn't do it without you. And I'm really excited for the future. It's a lot of work, but I think we have the right people at the table.
Well, I'm convinced that we're going to look back to the looking back. We're going to look back and say, you know what? We took this on. We worked together. We came up with the Massport model. Whatever that innovation is, that thing that propels us forward, and we're going to say this is where we solved it. That we solved it. And I'm convinced of it. Totally convinced of it.
And I'll add, you know, the industry here in Massachusetts is so fortunate to have leaders like Brian and Ken and the team at MassBio.
And Kendall.
Because we are collectively committed to this, and we're doers, right? We're not big ideas, we're executors. And so that's the mission here, and we understand the urgency around it.
And we're willing to put our necks on the line, right? Mm-hmm. You hear me saying it. Like, I'm literally putting it out there. I'm saying, yep, we're going to solve this. So you know what? 2 years from now, you're either going to look at me and go, he was blowing smoke up my skirt, or you know what? I'll be, goddamn, he did it. they freaking did it.
I choose option two.
Yeah.
I'm the only one wearing a skirt here. So
thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you for the invitation to be here. This was great.
It was
fun. This was absolutely fun. This was fun.